Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Wall Street, these days associated with greed, corruption, and blamed for the housing crisis, the banking crisis, and let's not forget, the Great Recession. But our guest today says, while some industry players deserve this battered reputation, the ideas of finance itself do not. In fact, he says finance is inherently moral and deeply rooted in our humanity. We're talking this hour with Harvard professor Mihir Desai. He teaches finance, tax law, and entrepreneurship. His new book, though, is not a number-laden account of how our financial system works. Instead, he describes its principles by drawing on another field, the humanities. That's right, the fundamentals of finance, as explained by Jane Austen, William Shakespeare, George Orwell, Herman Melville, all without a single chart or graph. The book is called The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. And that's what we're tackling today on The Exchange. And Professor Desai, welcome to The Exchange. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, one goal for this book, one really important goal, you say, is nothing short of making finance better, of restoring its humanity, its integrity. How does using literature, philosophy, poetry, et cetera, Professor Desai, accomplish that big goal?
Well, I think it's worthwhile just to begin with to acknowledge that parts of finance are broken. And I think many of our listeners will understand that. You know, we're deeply upset about the housing crisis, and we're deeply upset about what finance looks like from the outside. So we need to fix it. And the question is how to fix it. And, you know, clearly regulation has a role. Outrage has a role. But they're not sufficient. Regulation, we know, has some counterproductive effects. Many regulators are captured. So what we really need is for people who are in finance to start behaving better. And the way to do that is to ground them again in the underlying ideas. That, over the longer run, is the best thing we can do to make sure people start behaving well. Right now, expectations for people in finance are really low. If instead they kind of look to the underlying ideas, understand their nobility, then maybe they'll start to act in ways that live up to that ideal. So I really wanted to get away from this idea that we have to define down behavior in finance. I really want people in finance to aspire to behave in the way that these underlying ideas deserve, because in fact, they are quite noble.
How do your students feel about this battered reputation, which you say right up front in the book, Professor Desai, you know, Wall Street largely deserves. But how do the young people thinking about entering this field feel about that?
Well, it's interesting. I recently asked a bunch of graduating MBA students about it, and I asked who's going into finance, and then I asked them what people said when they told them that they were going into finance, and they kind of, you know, tittered, and they were, you know, basically suggesting that they feel slightly ashamed about going into finance. And none of them expected over the longer run to be in finance. And the reason that's problematic is finance is incredibly important. It's incredibly important to our economy, and it's incredibly important to our lives. So the fact that it's being viewed so negatively actually doesn't do anybody any service. So I think students, when I've presented these ideas, and in fact, this book began as a last lecture, I think they've really found it encouraging so that they can actually see finance through a moral lens. That's really what I wanted to do because, you know, right now finance by practitioners isn't viewed with a moral lens. It's just a set of things that people do. But if you look at your actions with a moral lens, there's a much greater likelihood that you're going to start behaving in a good way. And I think students also, they just really liked getting wisdom from their day-to-day work as opposed to being handed up from down, you know, from being handed it from on high, you know, which is they want to understand their life's work and philosophy together. They don't want them to be separate. And so I think for a lot of them, the idea that you can see philosophy in your life's work is really, really rewarding.
Well, how does this cynical view of finance hurt everybody. I mean, not just those in the industry or those thinking about getting into the industry, but everyone.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think financial markets are just so important to our economy, and they're important to our lives. So they're important to our economy because they are the lifeblood, right? The way capital flows in an economy is the lifeblood of the economy. Once capital markets and finance loses faith from the people, then we just start actually depriving our best enterprises of their lifeblood. You know, more specifically in terms of people's lives, I mean, think about the most important decisions, some of the most important decisions we make, which are, you know, should I invest in that education? Is it worth it? How do I think about how much debt I should take on? These are all fundamentally finance questions, and they're crucial to our lives. And people are, frankly, dramatically under-equipped to understand those ideas. So I think what the book tries to say is, well, look, wait a second, you need this in your life to be a functioning person and to be a good citizen. And we are woefully under-equipped to understand it. So one of the reasons why people are under-equipped is because they find it intimidating. So let's strip away all the intimidation. Let's just get the underlying ideas with stories. And then you can make these decisions in your life better. And we as a citizenry can think about finance better, as opposed to viewing it as a kind of, you know, somewhat scummy thing that happens on the side.
Well, right. Intimidating and distasteful. And you mention in the book, you know, all the examples, not just from our time, but from the past where finance is viewed as you put it, scummy. I want to just play a little bit, if I could, Professor Desai, a little bit from Michael Douglas. This is classic as Gordon Gekko in the famous scene from the 1987 movie Wall Street, where he's speaking before an audience of shareholders. There's a famous line in here that we'll talk about.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Okay, Professor Desai, I'm sure you've heard that clip 100 times. So how do you interpret that with this new, fresh look at how to understand finance? I mean, greed is good.
Well, I'm glad you played the whole clip, right? Because what most people usually hear is greed is good. I think, you know, the subtle, I think, way to understand this is there's an element of that that is true, which is self-interest is an important part of the way people behave. It's not the whole way people behave. And finance relies in part on people pursuing their self-interest. Excessive pursuit of that is greed, and excessive pursuit of that is not terribly good. But what finance tries to do is use some of those principles of self-interest, and indeed market economies generally use self-interest in some way, to kind of get us to a good outcome. And, you know, from my perspective, that works by and large. We have some significant problems today. The lack of rising median wages, the fact that people don't trust markets. But by and large, I think that works. What we have to do now is try to fix it. And I think the way to fix it is to make people in finance, you know, understand that Gordon Gekko piece you heard is ultimately kind of a caricature, and that they can't actually devolve into that. They got to be better than that.
Is it a caricature? I mean, a lot of people listening probably thought, yeah, that's how it is.
You know, it's funny because it is true. It's like, you know, what Philip, you know, Roth said, which is sometimes reality is even more fantastic than fiction. So there are people like Martin Shkreli who make Gordon Gekko look pretty good. So real life sometimes does outpace fiction. But, you know, there are people in finance like that. There's no question. And in my book, I try to tackle, you know, why some people in finance become like that. But I don't think that means that by and large people in finance are like that. You know, it's an incredibly large sector. It's something like 20% of employment. So, you know, people in finance are widespread, and they're not that caricature of the investment banker Gordon Gekko.
Well, so finance works because people are pursuing self-interest, trying to create value for others and create value for themselves. What are some of your favorite examples from the humanities, Professor Desai? Let's jump into this approach that show when people go overboard. You know, this is not something new that just sprang up in the 80s or the 2000s. I mean, this is classic. It goes way back.
Yeah, so I mean, some of the examples of finance and literature that kind of demonstrate how people go overboard are from the last century are fantastic. So my favorite novel about finance is Theodore Dreiser's The Financiers, which is this unbridled story. I'm sorry, the story of unbridled greed and ambition of this financier. And Dreiser gets all the details right, and he's fantastic. And he shows how these people become consumed by greed. If you look at Wall Street, or you look at Don DeLillo's Cosmopolis, or a variety of other books, American Psycho most notably, you get to see that. But the truth is those are caricatures, and there are people like that. But in fact, a lot of people in finance behave reasonably well. In the book, what I try to show is that, you know, most of the stories about finance are stories of the excesses, the ones I just mentioned. And what we need in our lives are good stories. So stories where people are doing finance but actually doing well. My favorite version of that is what I end the book with, which is this story by Willa Cather called O Pioneers, where she does all this financial stuff and does it really well. She borrows a lot of money. She hedges. She does all kinds of things. But she lives like a really, really good life. And so what I wanted to do is try to put together these stories that usually about finance are terrible, but then have good stories. Because if you have good stories, you can live a better life than if you have bad stories.
I want to play a little clip from O Pioneers, a book, Willa Cather's book. But it was made into a movie in 1991 starring Jessica Lange, and the heroine is Alexandra. This clip is a mix of voices, but it gives you the general theme, and then we can talk about it, Professor Desai. It starts with Alexandra's father advising her to keep the family's land for herself and her brothers. Let's hear.
You'll have to do the best you can for your brothers now. I want them to keep the land.
We will, Papa. We will never lose the land.
The property of a family belongs to the men of the family. They do the work.
It was all divided equally when you left to marry. What we each have since is of our own making.
People have started to talk.
Everybody knows Carla's just after your money.
Let people go on talking as they like.
Again, that's a clip from O Pioneers, a movie based on Willa Cather's book starring Jessica Lange. So let's dig into O Pioneers, Professor Desai, because this is maybe your favorite example of how finance is done right. So for people who haven't read this, just give us a quick synopsis of this, please.
Sure. Alexandra Bergson's this wonderful character. She's the older sister of two brothers. She has to inherit this land and is charged with trying to take care of the family. And it's not terribly good land. What she ends up doing is basically doing everything you do in a finance textbook. She leverages up her farm to buy more land. She goes and engages in some diversification so that she can actually pool some of her risks, which is a big idea in finance. She hedges those risks in various ways. She embodies a lot of the principles of finance. And ultimately, she succeeds. As you hear in that clip, the two brothers try to take it away from her because women aren't supposed to be able to, you know, have the land and have the riches of the land. She fights back, of course, and she wins. And the great thing about her is she's incredibly successful by the end of the book, but she embodies what the virtues of finance are. So, for example, when people try to say, oh, Alexandra, you did such a great job, you know, you're obviously brilliant, you know, she recognizes one of the big ideas in finance, which is that, you know, luck and skill are hard to separate. And she, instead of attributing all her success to herself, you know, attributes it to the land. And she says, you know, I was just here, the land did it. And so in that sense, she kind of completes a financial arc of borrowing and investing and diversifying and hedging. And she does all these things, but she doesn't succumb to the excesses. And that's why I really like that story, is because she really manages to embody finance without falling prey to these excesses. And that's, I think, what we need to do more generally, which is follow Alexandra Bergson. You know, many people in finance have a choice. You either follow Gecko or you follow Bergson.
From those
and
two
I guess
clips
what I wanted to do is make sure that they follow Bergson and not Gecko.
What incentive do people in finance, especially the young people going in who you work with, what incentive do they have to follow Alexandra, living a modest life, doing right by, you know, the community and by the family, versus, you know, Gecko, who's, you know, fabulously rich and has all sorts of lovely things?
Right. Well, I mean, Bergson, just to be clear, does just fine by herself. You know, she's actually quite successful. I think the real cost of that kind of path that is usually taken in finances is that it's really a hard way to live, because what you do is demeaned by many people. And, you know, to kind of feel good about yourself, you kind of have to separate it out from your personal life. And that's a hard way to live, right? You kind of partition your life. Like, at work, I do something kind of gross and evil, but at home, I'm a good person. That's a very, very hard way to live. And so it's a lot easier if you kind of view your work and your life as integrated. Yeah, I begin the book with this you know, a great Robert Frost quote about two tramps, which is just basically this idea that, you know, it's really hard if you have to live one life at work and another life at home. Yeah, you really want them to be integrated. So for young people, if you go into finance, you don't want to look at your work in such a negative way, because ultimately it'll eat at your self-image. And so that's, you know, again, that story I told about, you know, these young people at HBS who were kind of nervous about the reputation of finance. It's really hard for them. It's better to have it be integrated into your life and think positively. And then, of course, you'll behave better as well, because you'll have a moral lens on all those underlying ideas.
Do you think that young people today are avoiding careers in finance because of what we saw, you know, a decade ago? Or does it hold the same appeal?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, obviously, technology and technology companies have become all the rage very recently. And I'm sure that, you know, bubble will burst as well. But there's a solid core of 20%+ of kids who go into finance. And by the way, that's at a place like Harvard. If you go to places like, let's say, Ohio State, the School of Business, you know, 30-40% of kids will go into finance.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, you know, people don't realize it's a massive sector in the economy. And when we denigrate it and when we kind of talk about it in this way, it's really unfortunate, because then all those people who are going into it, you know, don't have very much to aspire to. It's a massive sector of the economy, and a lot of people are in it, and a lot of people aren't doing gecko-like stuff. You know, the vast majority of them are doing, you know, pretty good things.
The number for you to join us on The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, Harvard professor Mihir Desai presents Understanding Finance Without a Single Charter Graph, instead using the humanities from Shakespeare to Jane Austen to George Orwell. The book is called The Wisdom of Finance, and we're wondering what you think about this idea of discovering humanity in the world of finance. The number for you to join us with your comments and questions is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Have you used Professor Desai? I know this. You gave this speech 2 years ago, so you're still kind of working this out. But have you used the movie O Pioneer, the book O Pioneer, the movie Wall Street in your classes? I just wonder how students would respond to that.
Yeah, it's interesting, because when I first gave the talk, it was a quote-unquote last lecture. So students were graduating, and I was supposed to give them a talk. And I was going to give a typical finance talk about something going on in the financial markets. And then they told me, you know, they're graduating, so you're supposed to give them some wisdom. And so I decided, I came up with the title, The Wisdom of Finance, and then I decided I had to give a talk.
Up with the title first.
I always, you know, that's what happens to me many times in life, is you commit to doing something and then you got to do it. At that first, I just kind of figured out this correspondence, which is, hey, look, you can think about leverage in finance, but it actually has an analog in your life. You can think about mergers in finance, but it actually has this nice analog in life with marriage. What I did subsequently in writing the book is I didn't just want to share that correspondence. I wanted to tell all these stories. And that's when the humanities came into play, you know, which is by using all these stories and by using the humanities, we can humanize all these ideas. So I think many of my colleagues usually, you know, they usually start with a course and then they write a book. And for whatever reason, I went backwards.
Well,
which is, I wrote a book, and now I'd like to try to develop a course, because I think these ideas are fantastic. So I'm doing things a little bit backwards, but very much with the same aim.
We will jump into some more of these stories, how they explain finance, and we'll start taking your calls. After a short break, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Creative process isn't always easy, but getting distracted can be.
It feels like you're writing,
But it's the equivalent of empty calories.
If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day, it's not on Twitter.
The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, your source for the productive habits we can all benefit from, along with the guilty pleasures we can all relate to. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, Harvard professor Mihir Desai on understanding finance without a charter graph, instead using stories. Jane Austen, George Orwell, Herman Melville, Shakespeare. His new book is called The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Desai, we were talking about themes that show up in great literature and great movies. Greed is one. We played O Pioneer, where the main character is not greedy. She does it the right way. We played that classic clip from Wall Street. Another theme that comes up a lot in literature and film is trickery in finance. And I want to play a little clip now from The Big Short, the movie released in 2015.
I found something really interesting.
The whole housing market is propped up on these bad loans. They will fail.
The housing market is rock solid.
It's a time bomb.
So Mike Burry, who gets his hair cut at Supercuts and doesn't wear shoes, knows more than Alan Greenspan.
Dr. Mike Burry, yes, he does.
Okay, so a clip from the 2015 movie The Big Short. Probably a lot of listeners saw it because, you know, it was nominated and won some awards. What about that theme, Professor Desai, trickery? That comes up a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are the worst parts of finance. And we lived through obviously a terrible period that was in part sparked by, you know, bad behavior by people in finance. And I think that is the excess of finance, and that is what we have to fix. And that's the sense in which a lot of finance today is what I call value extraction rather than value creation. You know, that's a way of saying there's a limited pie, I take more, you get less. And sometimes that's done via trickery. What we need finance to do is to go back to value creation, which is, in fact, kind of the core of finance, you know, which is how is value created. So there is no doubt that kind of thing going on. But we really need finance to work, because if finance doesn't work, as I mentioned, economies can collapse and people's lives get very complicated. So the way to do that is to kind of say to ourselves, well, that, and call it what it is, which is there's a bunch of finance that's value extraction. And when you call it what it is, I think that helps. And then we can kind of reorient ourselves towards, you know, value creation, which a lot of finance does.
I think I know what you're getting at, but put it in real layperson terms. Like, value creation means, you know, loaning me money so I can start my cookie business.
Exactly right.
And so I put it on Main Street and everybody's happy.
Absolutely. So basic lending is just a huge part of finance and incredibly important for driving the economy. Companies that issue shares and then ultimately go public is a great way to build economies and great way to build jobs. The U.S. government borrows massive amounts to fund all their expenditures. You know, people invest in education in order to kind of get higher wages. You know, all of those things are being driven by financial markets. And so a lot of that is value creating. Now, when you end up with like a collateralized debt obligation, which is, you know, three derivative contracts away from some underlying asset, then you're really far away from value creation.
That's value extraction.
And then you're much more likely to be in value extraction. You know, so that's what we really want to do. And the book, the chapter on actually value creation, you know, tries to take finance to task to say, you know, look, there are chunks of what we do which really don't add that much value. And we should call it that. And we should understand that. And then that's the way to kind of getting back to doing these really great activities, which are so important for societies.
Let's take a call. And again, you can join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And up first is Bill in Merrimack. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. This is a wonderful discussion. I'd like to inquire with the professor as far as teaching these lessons to the new young people coming along. How does he reconcile it with the fact that you know, the most obvious and visible players are those who appear to err on the greed side as opposed to those who are reinvesting and lead a more, lead a more reserved lifestyle.
Yeah, so not a lot of good role models out there, Bill.
Exactly.
Right. Thank you so much for the call. And Professor Desai, what do you think?
Well, you know, I think two things. One is, I think young people, almost universally, they want to do the right thing. And they want to kind of aspire to something good as opposed to be defined downwards. So they're hungry for positive models. It's not as if they're looking to have negative models. So they're totally open to it. And then the second thing is, and the reason I use the humanities is, you know, it's funny. I came to appreciate stories again, right? And so I think what happened when I wrote the book was I realized that the humanities actually are wonderful in the sense of giving people examples and novels that they can aspire to. So instead of kind of choosing people kind of from the real world, I wanted to kind of ground it in stories because I think stories is what help people live. So, you know, that's a great question, Bill. I think the answer is one, people want good examples. So it's not as if you have to fight them to kind of believe in these stories. And then the second is, you know, you have to kind of at least come up with a few people who are actually doing something that is really wonderful. I chose the humanities because I think those stories are so resonant and they're so powerful morally. But there are people in the world who are doing great things in finance. I think a lot of people who are doing basic lending are doing something fantastic. You know, so I think there are a whole bunch of different examples like that. And kids want to hear them because finance, frankly, is really, really interesting. For the people who go into it, they love it and they want good stories.
Young people don't want to be defined downward. I like the way that you phrase that. And you used the example earlier of, again, Alexandra and Willa Cather's book, O Pioneers. What other sort of classic pieces or modern pieces of literature or film do you use in this book, Professor Desai, to give that younger generation positive role models for finance?
Well, a lot of the stories I tell are efforts to make them see the linkages between financial concepts and powerful ideas in one's life. So one obvious one that I use in the chapter on debt or leverage is The Merchant of Venice. So, you know, nominally, that's a story about debt. Right, which is there's a loan contract that kind of goes bad, and Shylock, who is in some ways the villain of that story, wants to extract his pound of flesh. But of course, you know, most of the scholars who study The Merchant of Venice know that that's not a play about debt. It's really a play about commitments. And all that wordplay on claims on people's bodies, for example, is a way of talking about commitments. So you can think about debt as some kind of a topic that's just financy and isolated from our lives, or you can understand it as a commitment. And that's what debt is. And commitments allow you to do all kinds of things. So just like people in finance love debt because it allows you to do things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise, commitments are like that too. Commitments to people in our lives, to jobs, to societies, are actually things that allow us to do more than we would be able to do otherwise. So, you know, by doing this kind of analog between debt and commitments, I wanted to take the idea of debt, which is, you know, frankly, some people view very problematically, some people love, and just anchor it in a humane idea, which is what debt is all about, which is I make a commitment to you, and then I get to do things I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
But I promise to pay you back.
I promise to pay you back. And it's a serious commitment, and it's a really serious commitment.
In The Merchant of Venice, yeah.
Exactly. In The Merchant of Venice, it's, you know, it ends up in a... But and that play is spectacular because, you know, the first time you read it, you know, Shylock is obviously problematic, but, you know, he's actually in some ways the victim, of course, because he's
the lender.
He's the lender.
Right.
And Antonio and Bassanio and Portia are this threesome who end up basically having debts to each other. So Bassanio becomes indebted to Antonio. Portia's indebted to Antonio because Antonio saves Bassanio. And there's a whole bunch of debt contracts
in there. That's Shakespeare.
And that's Shakespeare. And ultimately, it's about those commitments, which is exactly what debt is about in life, which is I take a loan and I get to do something I couldn't have done otherwise. Buy a house, invest in education, you know, whatever it is.
Well, and The Merchant of Venice is a fantastic example because you're right. It isn't just about debt. It's about human relationships and the, you know, the way that finance plays a role in those relationships, you know, love, revenge, money. We can't resist, Professor Desai, just playing a little clip from The Merchant of Venice. This is a movie made in 2004.
In Belmont is a lady richly left, and she is fair, and I'm but the means.
Try what my credit can in Venice do to furnish you to Belmont and fair Portia.
If you repay me not on such a day, let the forfeit be an equal pound of your fair flesh.
Okay, so if you ever wondered where the phrase a pound of flesh comes from, there it is. What else about this movie, about this wonderful work by Shakespeare, Professor Desai, kind of encapsulates what you're trying to get at here?
Well, so it's funny because the poet W.H. Auden wrote this great essay about The Merchant of Venice, and he basically said, you know, you think it's about finance, but in fact, there's no play by Shakespeare which is more about love than The Merchant of Venice, and that's his claim at least. So I love it because it shows the great side of debt and the negative side of debt, right? So the great side of debt is, again, you get to do things you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. But there is this complicated negative side to debt, which is people view it as morally questionable. And indeed, Antonio is a lender as well, but he chooses not to charge interest. So all the ambiguity over debt that we've suffered with for the last two millennia, where different religions and philosophies have kind of made debt sound terrible, is contrasted with the beauty of debt, you know, which is, wow, you get to do things you have no right to do by making a serious commitment. And that allows poor people to invest in education. That allows people to kind of, before they could afford a house, grow into a house that ultimately they'll be able to afford. So there's this real dichotomization in debt, which is we both love it because it allows us to do things, but we're deeply, deeply suspicious of it. And sometimes for good reason, because sometimes people use debt opportunistically. But that ambiguity is there in the play, and it's in finance. It's both this incredibly powerful tool, but then it can be used in this incredibly negative way as well. So that's what I love about the play. It's both those pieces of debt.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, it's professor and author Mihir Desai. His new book is called Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. And it's basically trying to understand finance by telling stories about how finance works, the basic fundamental principles and the relationships involved. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. And Professor Desai, let's go back to the phones. And Matt joins us from where? Hi, Matt. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hi. Professor Desai.
Go ahead.
Hi.
I just finished a fantastic book. It was published in 2017, and it's called The Mandibles, A Family. It follows an American family through an economic collapse of the United States, which is brought about by the American dollar losing its reserve status. Mm-hmm. And because economic collapse is followed by social collapse, the book deals with that as well.
Wow. That's a great point, Matt. Professor Desai, I'd love your thoughts. He's right. You know, and it's the point you keep making. It isn't just about the numbers on the spreadsheet. It's about the people and their lives.
Yeah. And in many ways, finance needs to get reconnected to people's lives. And I think, you know, Matt's making a deep point, which is our household economics are deeply tied to our lives. And, you know, we need to understand those economics and that finance picture to think about how we live. I mean, Matt gave a great example of kind of the descent of a family when there's chaos financially, what it leads to morally. I'll give you the opposite example, which is also a spectacular recent novel. It's by an Indian author. The name of the novel is Gutcher Gochar. And he basically talks about how there's this sudden increase in wealth in this Indian family. And it ends up causing kind of moral bankruptcy because they don't have the equipment to kind of think about what all that wealth has to do. The thing about both these examples that I like is, you know, they put finance front and center in people's lives. And they are fictional, but they make it clear that finance is central to our life. It isn't something terrible and horrible on the side. It's actually critical. So both of those, I think, are really good examples. One is an example of financial chaos. The other is an example of just sudden massive increases in wealth and how people start behaving in crazy ways as a result of that.
We often hear that that's what happens when people win the lottery, right? I mean, it sounds like that story.
Exactly. In fact, I think, you know, when I'm in Bombay or Shanghai or any of these places which have just had these explosions of wealth, you know, people are detached from reality a little bit because it's kind of coming as a sudden thing. And that novel really deals with the moral ambiguity of that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Matt. And let's take another one. This is Annie in Tamworth. Hi, Annie. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to ask the professor about something a little different. I just started reading a book called The Soul of Money. The author's name is Lynn Twist, and she talks about money as a kind of energy and how there's some fallacies that we never have enough. And she talks about it as like a flow, and if it's stagnant, then it can hurt the economy, and it's got to keep moving. And I don't know, I was just wondering if the professor's book talks about that at all, too. I found the concept fascinating.
Wow, Annie, thank you so much. Does money have a soul? That is a great question.
Yeah, you know, I'm not familiar with the book, but I think there's something there, right? Which is, in fact, the epigraph for my book is from Wallace Stevens, who's a poet, a great American poet, who said, money is a kind of poetry. And he, you know, is a guy who wrote the most beautiful poetry, but he was an insurance executive his whole life. And everybody said, what are you doing staying in insurance when you could be a poet full time? And he said, you know, poetry and insurance really aren't that different. You know, which for many people is crazy,
really?
Right, Laura? Which is, many people say insurance is the most mundane, boring thing in the world. But Stevens saw in insurance, as other people have, like the soul of humanity. The reason that's great, and I like this idea of this book that was mentioned, is we tend to think about those worlds separately. There's money, which is crass and gross and disgusting and, you know, sometimes evil. And then there's our lives, which have to be pristine and moral. Only by bringing them together can we actually live a moral life when it comes to finance. So I think what this book is trying to do, as far as I understand it, the one that she mentioned, I think it's great. We need more integration of those parts of our lives as opposed to division.
Well, and your book tries to do that. And also on our website, Professor Desai, we put up your quiz, Can You Find the Artist Among these bankers and these entrepreneurs? And just give us a little flavor of that. Again, it's on our website, but that's where you actually tell us about a lot of people who we know for their art or their literature or their poetry, but they actually worked in finance.
Yeah, it's one of the things I found out while I was writing the book, which is there are these incredible figures who you know for their artistic accomplishments, but who were massively interested in finance. I won't give away the answers, but you know, one of the most important composers of the last 120 years led the largest insurance agency in the country. He created it. There are people who again could have been writing literature full time, but they preferred to stay in banking, and they actually loved banking, according to the people close to them. So there are all these examples of people who actually have a root in finance. And yet they were still able to undertake these great humanitarian things. Wallace Stevens is another example that I just mentioned, a guy who loved insurance so much that he would never give it up so he could become, he was actually offered the Charles Eliot Norton Professorship of Poetry at Harvard, and he said no.
He stayed in insurance.
He wanted to stay at the Hartford.
Wow.
which is hard to believe, but he understood something about insurance that I try to make clear in the book.
Well, and again, we put that quiz on our website. And even if you fail miserably like I did, you learn a lot from it. It's pretty amazing. We will talk more after a short break. And keep taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Contrary to its public image, our guest today says finance is inherently moral and deeply rooted in our very humanity. His new book explores the fundamentals of finance through storytelling. There's not a single chart or graph in it, but lots of great stories from all sorts of classic literature and film. We're talking with Harvard professor Mihir Desai. The book is called The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And Professor Desai, let's go right back to our listeners and Jackson Amherst. Hi, Jack. Thanks for being with us. You're on the air.
Thanks for putting this topic on. I have been listening to you forever, but I've never called.
Oh, well, welcome. But
because of this topic, I had to call. So I actually worked in finance for about 30 years, the last 10 of which I spent primarily training new folks in the industry, and just retired. And one of the things that I kept coming back to over and over again is the humanity, the values that are embedded in finance, and how important that is when you're dealing with folks. And young people are very receptive to that. And once they realize the opportunity to do good, they really embrace it. And it's a great industry for that reason for young folks.
Wow, that's amazing. So contrary to the image of, you know, greed and it's all about me, 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 Jack, you're saying there's some hope.
Exactly. It's all about the people that you're helping. And if you can impart knowledge that way with the young folks, they fully embrace it. They get it. And I just feel very hopeful for the industry for that reason. And I also wanted to make mention, it was really ironic that you were talking about artists and poets and whatnot. I am actually a musician as well, and thought I was going to do that full-time way back in the day, but now I'm going back to it. But I'm one of those folks who, you know, is a performing artist and songwriter and whatnot, and I just find so many connections between the music world and the finance world. It's a very powerful thing. So,
well, Jack, it's great
it really
to hear from you.
Down to the humanity of it all.
Well, I really appreciate the call. And you talked earlier, you know, Professor Desai, about those connections. And there's another one, a musician and a person in finance.
Yeah, it's great to hear that because it kind of belies the caricature we usually think of with finance. Jack, just I love that story. It's fantastic and inspiring. And I really think what you were trying to do is wonderful and continue to try to do. Just one of the things that I try to do in the book that's really fantastic is there's a song, actually, Jack, that you might enjoy, which is No Romance Without Finance. It's a Tiny Grimes song. It's a kind of bebop classic, but it brings together two ideas, romance and finance, in a song that you would never have done. But the important point that Jack is raising is that finance, and this is what Alexander Bergson understood, is that in finance you are stewards of people's capital. You're serving somebody. And if you're serving somebody, that's a very different lens than it's about me, me, me. Right? If you're serving somebody and you're a steward of their capital, that is a wonderful way to think about life. And the final thing I'll say is, you know, Jack also raises this question, which is finance is being remade today by a lot of entrepreneurs, and financial technology is massively important. People are changing student loan markets. And so, you know, a lot of the old caricatures are going to give way because people want finance to work for people as opposed to, again, work against them via value extraction.
Well, speaking of, what did you say? No romance without money? Was that the exact?
It's no romance without finance.
No romance without finance. I want to play a clip from another book made into a movie that you draw on a lot, Professor Desai, in your book. This is from a 2016 adaptation of a Jane Austen novel. The movie is called Love and Friendship, and it's a perfect example of how people used to view marriage not as about love at all, but as an economic relationship. Let's hear.
My brother-in-law is very rich. In one's plight, they say, is one's opportunity.
Sir James Martin, vastly rich, rather simple. If my daughter were not the greatest simpleton on earth, she'd be engaged to him now.
But, Mama, I can see Sir James is a kind man, but marriage is for one's whole life.
Not in my experience.
Okay, it's worth playing that clip just for the British accents and the music.
But well, yeah.
Go ahead, Professor Desai. Jane Austen, she provides a lot of fodder for you in this book.
Yeah, well, there's two things in that clip I think that are really clear. You know, one is You know, for several, many centuries, marriage and love was about economics as much as it was about, you know, emotions. And so, in fact, in the book, the chapter on mergers tries to make clear that people have thought about marriages as mergers between companies for many centuries. And in fact, the folklore around mergers can actually help us understand marriage. The greatest thing about Jane Austen, of course, is that many of these plot lines, I use Pride and Prejudice, are about young women facing the risk of the marriage market. You know, basically, it's a very risky situation for a young woman in those novels. And then these suitors come by. And as you heard in that clip, some of them are terrible, some of them are good, some of them are risky in certain ways. And they're basically about, in Pride and Prejudice, Lizzie Bennet navigating that. So Mr. Collins, when he gives the worst proposal ever, you know, he basically says, you know, you're not that pretty, you're not that rich, so you better marry me.
great.
He's playing, it's the greatest, it's the worst proposal literally ever. Lizzie Bennet, you know, he's trying to play on her risk aversion. And she says, no, 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 I'm going to roll the dice. I'm going to keep going. And of course, it ends up fabulously. Of course, Charlotte, the next day, takes Mr. Collins's offer because she wants to manage that risk in a different way. So Jane Austen and, in fact, Anthony Trollope in that chapter become guides to risk management, because when you're faced with those risks, it turns out those characters divined the same devices we use today to manage risk, which are options and diversification. So they give voice to that same logic 100 years before modern financial theory. But again, it shows that a lot of these ideas are rooted, you know, deeply in our humanity.
So risk management and the risks of mergers through Jane Austen, it kind of makes sense because back then, I'm guessing, Professor Desai, the family kind of was the company. I mean, if you were a farmer, then, you know, all the family was on the farm and that was the business. If you were a lord, then you sort of had your interests there. So in a way, a marriage really was a financial merger.
Yeah, no, I think in the chapter on marriages, I go through and show how, in fact, marriages have been mergers for a long time, and including perhaps up until today. You know, it's kind of amusing. Many people look at the Sunday New York Times and the wedding pages. They call them the M&A pages, the mergers and acquisitions pages, because they are kind of mergers between families in many, many ways. So I think there's a deep logic there. And in fact, the folklore in finance around mergers and why mergers go wrong, you know, applies surprisingly well to marriages. So, for example, why do most mergers fail? This is a little financy, but hopefully it'll work for some of you, which is the first reason why is synergies are overestimated. You know, that's a way of saying we think we can bring two organizations together really quickly and get the benefit without actually a lot of work. Those are synergies. That's the same mistake people make in marriage, you know, which is they think that
jumping
it's
in too
be
early.
Easy to change. Yeah, and it's going to be easy to change organizations. Integration planning is always underdone. No one thinks about marriage. They think about the wedding. Serial acquirers, you know, often end up hollow shells. You know, companies that just kind of go and buy a lot of companies usually end up as hollow shells, which I think applies in the marriage market as well. So that's the cheekiest chapter of all. But it tries to, again, root these ideas that finance gives us and apply them to something in our lives.
Well, so if you decide you want to give up the Harvard professor thing, you could go into marriage counseling, I don't know, prenuptials and all that stuff.
I think I'm just fine, yeah.
You're fine where you are. A couple of emails have come in, Professor Desai, and here's one. Karen wants to know, how does Ayn Rand and her objectivism fit into the professor's theory? Karen, thank you. Does Ayn Rand come up in the book, Professor Desai?
Yeah, it's interesting. So she doesn't. And, you know, Ayn Rand is obviously a very powerful and popular storyteller. She, in many ways, is the exponent of pure self-interest, right? So if you think about her novels like The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, she kind of proposes extreme self-interest as the way to kind of guide things. And, you know, I personally don't subscribe to that set of ideas. There was a time in my life, and I think there was a time in many people's lives when they found those appealing. I ultimately, you know, I find that a little bit incomplete because I think there's a lot in life which is not about that. So she's an incredible storyteller. And in a way, she is a manifestation of this idea of self-interest, but you know, to my taste at least, and nothing against her as an author, it's a little bit extreme for my taste.
Well, there is a parable that you have in the book that kind of relates, though, to this sort of Ayn Rand theme of like talent and skill. And if you're rich, you deserve to be rich because you're super talented. So what is that one? You do use that one in the book.
So this is an incredible story from the book of Matthew in the Bible, which is called the Parable of the Talents. You know, today we understand talents to be, you know, things that make us special. But of course, talent historically meant money. And in that parable means money. So again, there's another link between our humanity and finance. But the great thing about that story is it's actually very, very harsh. In short, there's a master who is about to go on a trip. He divides up his wealth, these kind of talents he has amongst these three servants. One, he gives 5 talents. Another, he gives 3 talents. And the third, he gives 1 talent. And he says, I'm going to go away. You take care of this and I'll come back. And, you know, of course, the master is meant to be the Lord and the servants are meant to be human beings. He comes back. The guy with 5 talents says to the master, here, I've made them into 10 by lending them and by investing. And the master, Lord, says, you know, wonderful job. You're terrific. The one who did 3 made it into 6. Same thing. And then the poor guy who had 1 talent goes to the master and says, sir, I was quite nervous and quite scared, so I just buried the talent, but I have it here for you. Here it is, back to you. And the
so
master
I haven't lost with, it. I, you know, I didn't waste it.
I didn't lose it, but I preserved it for you.
Yeah.
And the master says, basically casts him out of the kingdom. So it's this incredibly harsh story, which is you have to take what you're given and make it into more. That is the story of value creation in finance. But it's also a very, very harsh story because you kind of wonder, wait, why did that one guy get punished so much? And he only had 1 talent. Why are you punishing him so much? So that parable, I think, is like a version of this Randian view, which is people who make a lot of their talents do well, and that's the way it should be. What I try to do in that chapter is contrast that with the parable of the workers in the vineyard, which has a very, very different moral, you know, which is... you know, everybody gets the same basic amount in that parable. And the combination of those two parables are what finance is in many ways about. Most people just take that Randian parable of the talents and they view it that way. I'm in finance. I did really well. I'm great. I deserve what I got. And they forget about the humility of the parable of the workers in the vineyard, you know, which is, you know, we should all look after each other and we should not be concerned if all of us end up with something the same. And finally, a lot of what we get is not the result of our skill, but just a matter of luck. Mm. So that, I think, is a great lesson. And you're right, it's a contrast between the Randian view of I'm a great individual, I've done great things, I deserve great things, with something that's a little bit more humble, which I think is what finance is actually, which is, you know, well, people are born with different things. You never know the difference between luck and skill. And so you should never attribute outcomes to yourself. As opposed to perhaps the circumstance. Again, this goes back to Alexandra Bergson and the way she talked about her own success.
Well, Karen, thanks a lot for the email. Engendered a lot of discussion there. There's a concept, Professor Desai, that I have to ask you about because honestly, I had not heard of it until I read this book. But it turns out it was huge in Europe for a time. It had enormous popularity in this country, you know, 150, 200 years ago, called, I hope I pronounce it right, the Tontine.
The Tontine.
Tontine. What is this?
The Tontine.
This was a
incredible...
big deal.
Indeed. So Tontines were, in fact, a large chunk of American financial assets at the turn of the last century. Sorry, the turn of the, around early 1900s. And they were basically insurance. But here's the trick. They were not insurance against, for example, dying or something bad happening to you with your health. They were insurance against living too long. So the big risk in life that people were worried about is I'm going to outlive my financial assets. So what does a tontine do? You all pool your capital and you put it into this thing called a tontine. And then as people die off, their share goes to let the other people live longer. So if you end up living really, really long, you get to have all these assets at your disposal. Underlying idea is the risk you're worried about is living too long and outliving your assets. And this risk pooling mechanism allows you to kind of come together in that way and hedge the risk of living too long. So it was an incredible instrument during the French Revolution and in English public finances all the way up until the turn of the last century. The reason I use that story is it just first off, it demonstrates insurance, you know, which is in a really strange setting, which is we pool our risks and we're made better off by it. In many ways, today's health insurance debate is about how we should pool risks and who should be pooled together. And people have very, very different views about that. But the second reason I use it is because it demonstrates how things can go wrong in insurance. So the first example is in the French Revolution again, where these kind of financial engineers end up basically buying these tontines for these young Swiss girls who are going to live a really, really long time. And they basically game the French public finance system for their benefit.
Wow.
You know, it's probably our first example of financial engineering and securitization. It's,
well, who
it's a wonderful
knew?
Story. Yeah. And then the second principle that it illustrates is moral hazard, you know, because it also features in The Simpsons. There's a great tontine in The Simpsons where one of the problems is you're kind of given an incentive to be the last person alive, which in The Simpsons means, you know, kill other people.
Right.
So it's just something that really traces through, and that's moral hazard generally, which is insurance makes you do things you wouldn't do otherwise.
Well, here's
so it's a really odd instrument that I think illustrates all this stuff.
Here's one more email, and I apologize for throwing this at you at the last minute, but this is a great comment that this person had. This person says, isn't human nature such that, whether in politics or finance, the movers and shakers have to go along to get along? So by the time they get to the top, they are corrupted and make the whole system operate badly. And this person didn't give a name, but thank you for the email. And, you know, we're almost close to the end, but I have to ask you what you think about that, Professor Desai.
God, I hope that's not true. So, I mean, I think, you know, before we drop off the existential cliff at the end of the hour, I believe in something different, you know, which is I believe actually that that may be true sometimes. But in fact, there's a lot of capacity for good behavior to get you really, really far. You know, at the very, very top, are there compromises that have to be made in a lot of these settings? Perhaps. But I think for the vast majority of that journey, you can keep your character intact and not succumb to that. And in fact, of course, that's exactly what we need as a society. You know, more people who are willing to keep their character intact as long as possible and as they progress up their career.
Be like Alexandra in O Pioneers.
Exactly.
Professor Desai, this has been great. Thank you so much for taking the time for us.
My pleasure. It's really fun and great questions.
That's Mihir Desai, professor at Harvard Business School and Harvard Law, where he teaches finance, tax law, and entrepreneurship. His new book is called The Wisdom of Finance, Discovering Humanity in the World of Risk and Return. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.